Amy at 97 FM in Springfield, and my show is Radioactive. Can anyone out there hear me?
Sick of silence, let it out.
This is Ethan from LA,
I'm 16, but I'm not sweet.
Are you running the streets? Call the Rio Runaway Hotline.
KCAT, Los Gatos, California.
This is, I am. Are you?
This is No Protection, out from New Jersey.
Hi, you're on the air.
Turn on the truth.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, B-Fan Podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and as always, thank you for giving me your time. Today, I got two guests on. I got my dad, and I got my friend Aurelio, so you guys can decide who's going to go first inside the introductions.
Well, Paul's going to go first, I say.
Okay, then I'll go first. Yes, I am Austin's dad, Antonio Enix, all the way here from Detroit.
Aurelio?
Aurelio Beattie.
All right, so who want to go first with, I don't know, maybe a little bit of background. You got too many stories to get into to go from.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So we can start with you.
Well, you know, name's Aurelio Beattie. Grew up in near Santa Barbara County.
Okay.
Actually, small town, Santa Maria. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you guys heard of it, but it's in the Central Coast. I'm an entrepreneur, you know, started my own, like, service-based business right now. And so,
talk about it. Go ahead.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah. So I think, what should I get into? You know, maybe...
When you first
what got
started?
Me into entrepreneurship, you know? When I started entrepreneurship, it was first like a means to make money.
Yeah.
I had a goal to get to USC. Mm-hmm. It didn't first start out like that. I first, after high school, I didn't want to go to
college.
I didn't really care for any like university like that. Didn't even apply. I was just like, I'm going to go to community school that's nearby. So went to community college. And at the time, you know, my girlfriend Olivia, she started telling me that she wanted to go to USC and she was going to community college at the same time. And she was like, you know what? Let me she showed me that it was actually possible to get there. You know? Funny thing is I went to the community college. I dropped out. And then she was like, no, you got to go to USC. Try going. So I applied myself. I went to, did my 2 years and then I transferred out over here.
Yeah.
But during that time, I was kind of conscious about like money. You know, and I was like, you know, I need to figure out a ways to make money. If I'm going to go to such a prestigious school like USC, everybody's balling out over here, to be honest, you know. And so I was like, what's a way I could get into like just making money kind of quick? So I was like, why not start pressure washing? I see all the TikTok videos. It looks easy.
Mm. Yeah.
I started with I got a pressure washer.
Facebook Marketplace.
Bro, I went to the like websites. Like I was trying to be legit, you know.
Yeah.
I got the everything I needed for pressure washing, and you know, I was making a few hundred bucks here and there. The way I got my clients was just by doing yard signs. Actually.
Really?
I first started with yard signs.
Okay.
I was out there like 2 a.m. with my brother. We'd be out there for 4 hours putting out yard signs and out of the corners of the blocks. And then got my first customers there. I think I told you I got into an accident where I was cleaning a roof.
Yeah.
Got chemicals on my legs and got these horrible chemical burns, you know, so I had to stop pressure washing. I was like, you know, I need to get into something a lot easier. And that's quicker. So I started doing window cleaning, door-to-door sales. And during that, I actually learned like a valuable skill of like what sales is, you know, how to sell, especially door-to-door. You know, people don't really like you coming up to the door and just kind of yapping, you know, and selling them, you know.
Yep.
So I learned how to like not come across like I'm selling, you know,
how
to get them excited for what I'm selling.
Uh-huh.
And then building like that social proof, and I actually built a team of salesmen. So I had like a five guys who would sell, five guys who would clean, and we were like on the spot services.
Yeah.
And we were like doing really good. We hit from anywhere from, depending on how big the team was, it would be like 1,000 to 5,000 in a single day.
A single day.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And so, but when I got here, it was really hard to manage.
From
you know?
Here all the way back to Santa mm-hmm. Maria.
And I figured, I was like, you know, it's really a seasonal thing, you know, so, you know, during when the sun's out, you know, that's when, you know,
see the
strike while
marks.
The iron's hot,
yeah.
You know, and then during the cold seasons, just I'm focusing on now rebranding my business. I'm
how trying can to I hit scale more, it.
Yeah. Learning how to scale it. You know, I'm really like new into this,
mm-hmm.
but I'm eager to learn.
But aren't
know?
We all?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
So before we get to my dad, one thing about I can hold the question. You can introduce yourself.
Okay, Antonio Enix. Like you said, I am Austin's dad, right? And in the spirit of entrepreneurship, you know, even though I'm on my third career, I pretty much started my own business back in 2000 when I graduated from college, right? Coming out of college, there was really no workforce, you know, because when you think about the dawn of the information age, coming out of the industrial age. A lot of the opportunities that were there that people had almost anticipated would still be there wasn't there. So when I graduated, I want to say the major automotive companies probably had laid off close to 70,000 people.
Dang.
Right. And what happened was is that I'm like, man, I went to school all these years. I got my undergraduate degree. I had a background in quality auditing.
Yeah.
Total quality management, things like that, you know, related to industrial distribution. Then they changed the term from industrial distribution to supply chain management.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Right. So when I got home, I'm thinking, hey, look, I got all of this energy, all of this, you know, all of these things that I wanted to do and see my city in a different light. And when I got back, it was nothing happening. You know, jobs had been leaving Detroit for years. Mm-hmm. So where the unemployment rate nationally might have been 9%, it was close to probably 30, 40, or 50% in Detroit. We're talking about a school system that had like a 98% poverty rate. So what happened was is I ran into a buddy of mine that I had graduated from high school with. His uncle had a youth center called Barnabas Youth Opportunity Center.
Yeah.
And it was an entrepreneurial center where they taught kids how to, you know, they had a wood shop, you know, so they taught kids how to make signs and sell those signs to those that lived in the community. So when I got down there, the youth center was located in a place called the Empowerment Zone within Detroit. So that's where a lot of the neighborhoods were racked with unemployment,
mm-hmm.
Dilapidated. High percentage of people that were homeless, things like that. And then you had all of these impoverished families. And the whole goal when I got to that youth center is was trying to figure out how to bridge the digital divide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the internet now is not what the internet was then when I was graduating from college. You know, it was still dial up, it was still slow. It was still new technology that they didn't have access to.
Mm-hmm.
So where, you know, you had people, you know, like I mentioned before, a high percentage of people that were unemployed. The guy that owned the center, he just passed recently. He was one of my mentors. I learned a lot from him. And I'm like, man, you know, I'm really out here. I'm trying to find a job. And he said, you know, there's plenty of jobs out there. He said, if you look out and you identify and you look at all of these different problems, he said, there's so much opportunity out here for entrepreneurs. You just got to look out there and figure out which need you want to attack.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I came up with the idea of a Wake Community Learning Center.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what that is at the time was an opportunity to provide programming for people who really didn't have the resources to go after their opportunities. Mm-hmm. And you know, people very rarely become anything that they've never seen. So what happens is that, you know, they grow up with all of these examples, and then they have these aha moments where they may see something on TV or they may meet a person, right? And I just wanted to give people the experience of becoming a better version of themselves. Because they didn't know, when you talk to people and say they grew up disenfranchised or at a disadvantage, right, they don't know that they're poor.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're living in it. That's because what we were talking about yesterday.
Because they're living in it. And see that, and we weren't, I mean, you know, my dad went to work every day. You know, my mom, they got married when they were 16 to 17 years old. They've been married 50 years. So I'm pretty sure growing up there were hard times, right? But we've always had that entrepreneurial spirit where it wasn't about looking for a job as much as it was about creating opportunity. And creating a job for yourself,
you making know, something happen,
making something happen.
Yeah, so, cool. Yeah. So really,
coming from a real entrepreneur.
So, back to you with the door-to-door sales.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? Just learning that process, because I'm sure you didn't. The first person that opened the door was like super excited to see Aurelio Beatty.
No.
So how did that go for you in terms of a learning process and being able to build up that confidence to knock on a stranger's door, not knowing what they're gonna open up looking like? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So. Talk
there's,
a little bit
there's
about
There's a
it.
Lot of, like, weird experiences, you know?
Yeah.
Because you meet all kinds of people. But when I first started, I was just, you know, I wanted to make some money. You know, it was driving me. That was where the motivation was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I actually, when I first started door-to-door, now thinking about it, it was with my girlfriend.
Yeah.
And we would go, she would actually go door-to-door, ask people if we could do, like, those curb stencils.
Oh, with the addresses.
With the addresses, with the numbers and stuff.
Yeah, they came to our house in Detroit. Oh, yeah? We was like the only ones who got it.
It was the biggest hustle.
Oh, yeah.
They made it like this is being mandated by the city.
What?
And they did it, and I paid for it. And I looked outside, and I said, Austin, it's only two houses on the whole block ahead of them.
Wow.
But go ahead. The stencils in the, yeah.
Me and her at the time were like, you know, this is going to help us make a lot more money than just working at like a pizza spot that we're working at the time. That's what we thought.
Yeah.
You know, getting people to actually like buy like a $20 stencil job, you know, it's a lot harder than you think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was too scared to actually go to door to door. I had this idea that for some reason that they just wouldn't like me.
Right.
You know, that they would like judge me just based off like my race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that like, oh, there's just some, you know, kid. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to get too like.
No, it get like that.
You know,
but
like
ahead,
that's
yeah,
at my door just trying to make some money, you know. And mm-hmm. that's not, you know, I put that barrier on myself.
Right.
And so she would do the door to door, and I was just working the stencils, you know, I was busting those out.
You do the dirty work.
Yeah. Yeah. Dream work.
My hands look like this, so her hands look like
But, you know, for some reason, I didn't like the idea of her doing it, you know, really, like, going door to door. You meet weird people.
Yeah.
On top of it, like, we didn't make any money. We were like, we're making $10 an hour. We go work at a pizza bar. We're still making 12, you know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So we just, that was, like, when I first started door to door, when I really got into it for window cleaning,
mm-hmm.
I was like, you know, if I know that if I put my mind to it,
yeah,
I would achieve it. Mm-hmm. And that's something my dad would tell me. He's like, you know, I always recognize like when you say you're going to do something and you actually mean it, you know, you always achieve it. And I knew that it would come whatever I put first, whatever I put forth, you know, I was going to get back. So I was like, if I'm going to work hard, if I work hard at this, then I'm going to see a return in it.
Yeah.
And so what got me motivated, though, was I actually was like, you know, I'm going to invest in myself and pay for a course.
Yeah.
So I started doing, it was like $4,800 at how to do door-to-door sales, you know, specifically for window cleaning. And that's just kind of built the courage. I was like, I got to make these payments.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't spend $4,800 for nothing.
So, yeah,
so I was like, I need to start door knocking. I was like, you know what? If I go out and I knock for at least 8 hours a day, I can make $300.
Yeah, you can make something out of it.
I'll make something. I'm not going to walk out with nothing. If I got to talk to 200 people, I'm going to talk to 200 people. I'll make my $150 for the day.
Yeah.
You know? So that's what I did. Mm-hmm. I went the first day. I only got one person.
Yeah.
And I was so thankful.
Yeah.
And that's just what got the ball rolling. You know, I spoke to her. She was like, you know what? I'll give you a shot.
Yeah.
She gave me a shot. I did it. I came back the next day, did it for $150. And I was like, I'm going to keep doing this.
Yeah.
So every, you know, whenever I was doing school at the time. So after school or on the weekends, I was like, I'm going to work 4 days out the week and just work my butt
get
off.
Straight
you know?
To it. Yeah, yeah.
And at the time, I didn't have the equipment that I had. I have currently, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's like water fed poles and makes it a lot easier for cleaning two stories.
Yeah.
I was just only able to hit one story. So it made it a lot harder.
I can get you downstairs. I can't get you upstairs.
Exactly.
I can get you downstairs.
So it just built my confidence in like being resourceful.
Yeah.
Not knowing that like I have all the resources I need. I just need to be resourceful with what I got.
Yeah.
So I used what I had. I was like, give me a squeegee, give me some Dawn dish soap. I'm going to just clean these windows,
And
so
it just built
like internal confidence in me. Like I could do anything,
You
know? So when it came to door to door, that was it was like when I got the ball rolling, you know, I got better and better every day. You know, I just applied myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, was able to see a return from it, you know, which was great. And then
that's tough.
I knew I got good when I started being able to teach other people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, and, you know, building confidence is just like building a house. You got to build the foundation. You get the foundation going. Now you can build brick by brick, and it's going to be experience by experience that's going to build that confidence. Mm. You know, people don't come out the womb, you know what I'm saying, saucing everybody up. You know what I'm saying? You're not born with the sauce. You got to get the sauce.
Exactly.
That's what Gucci Mane saying. That you got to get the sauce. How you going to be born with the sauce? You can't be born with seasoning. You know what I'm saying? But you got to be able to be willing to go out and build that confidence. Like right now, I'm on a high. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like I'm doing my thing. I go out and now I've built this mindset to where it's like I'm unbreakable almost. So I could approach anybody about anything and I feel like I'll be 100% successful in whatever I do. And even if I do get shot down, I'm still successful because if that door wasn't opening for me, maybe it was a reason it wasn't supposed to open. How can I learn from this? How can I learn from this down, you know what I'm saying, this downtime?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody put me down. How can I get over it? How can I get through it? What can I do to, you know what I'm saying, improve myself? And not looking from a lack of standpoint, like, oh, why am I this, and that, becoming insecure about it, but in a standpoint to where it's like, okay, it must be something for me to build. It must be somewhere I can improve. So,
Yeah,
that's how it goes.
Well, you know, like for me, it was trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be honest with you, I'm an entrepreneur, right? But I'm on my, like my third career.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the reason being is because I got 2 degrees, had 2 kids to raise, you know, so I couldn't really just drop everything and run after my dream, right? But slow and steady, you know, being consistent and setting goals and planning your business,
mm-hmm.
you know, has put me in a position where, you know, after I'm finishing my third career now, you know, I can go ahead and just do me full time, right?
Yeah.
But what kind of translate or cuts through all of that is enthusiasm, you know? So it's the enthusiasm that you have after you've already had one of those setbacks, right?
Yeah.
And you don't let it get you down. Mm-hmm. You wake up, like you said, the next day and you say, you know what, I'm getting ready to do this.
Do it again.
And I'm getting ready to go after it. And I mean, I guess he gets it from me because I was just that, you know, I always ran towards it, never ran from it. Mm. And I'm like, hey, if it doesn't kill me, definitely it'll make me stronger.
Yeah, and then even when you was talking about visualizing or saying what you're going to do and then actually doing it, I think it's been like that, like, my whole sports career. You know what I mean? Like, even when I've been playing sports, I don't got too many job careers yet to reflect back on, but maybe in a few years I will. But in terms of sports, I remember I started playing football again, like, in, like, my junior year of high school. I played when I was a kid. I was really good, but then I walked away from the sport due to some coaching stuff. But I came back my junior year of high school, and I'm coming back into it like I ain't never left. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I'm back on my feet now. And I'm tearing everybody up at practice, you know what I mean? Yeah. Boom, boom. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, Austin Tuck. We get to the game, but I'm not getting in. So I'm like, all right, what's going on? So I'll talk to the trainer at practice or whatever, the receiver trainer or the strength coach that we had. And I'll be like, dog, all they got to do is give me the ball one time. You know what I'm saying? I'm a pop off like this. I'm going to do that. And, you know, oftentimes we hear people with those same stories like, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. But, like, me when I'm saying it, it's like I'm getting mad because I know I can do it. And I finally got the opportunity. It was like the week after I said I was going to quit, I was telling my dad in the car, and I'm like, man, I'm done. I'm putting the pads up. I'm done. I'm about to go grab my shoes again. We're about to lace up, and we're going back to hooping. Like, not even in a I'm a quit type of way, but I know my worth, and I'm not going to keep, you know what I'm saying, messing around with y'all, and I can be doing something else with my time. So I'm like, man, I'm done. He like, all right. Stick it out. Just one more week. I'm like, whatever. So I was like, all right, I'll do it one more week. The middle of that week, or, like, even the beginning, we lost our star receiver. Like, he had ended up breaking his ankle or something at practice, and things had to change. So they moved one of my friends up, Elijah Dotson. Oh, my God, he's going to be so good. I hype him up every time I hear him. He's going to be really good. But Elijah, he came up to play the position that the guy that had left. We moved my friend Nicholas Johnson back to running back, and they was like, all right, Austin, we need you now. So they put me in. My first game starting, I had, like, what? 5-6 catches for like 100 yards. Like, I wasn't dropping nothing. You know what I'm saying? I'm going, I'm moving. And the trainer was like, man, yeah. And everybody all excited about it or whatever.
Was that the Catholic Central game?
Yeah, that was the Catholic Central game, man. Everybody all excited about it. And my trainer like, nah, he been saying he gonna do this. Like, I've watched him talk to me and tell me all they gotta do is give me the ball. And one thing I'm not gonna do is like go sit and complain to a higher authority. I believe that actions are better than words. And I would rather keep busting up everybody at practice and watch the team slowly, you know, decline because they ain't giving me the shot and let other people bring it up than me go to tell them something that is going to make it even harder for me to prove or whatever, if that makes sense. Yeah. I'd rather just put my work in, understand where I'm coming from, so then I'm doing it for me. I know I'm doing this for some reason outside of whatever they think. I know I'm working hard, and if I don't get the shot yet, maybe I should work harder. Maybe it's something for me to improve. So just keeping that mindset that it's like, just get to it, and then whatever's done in the dark will come to the light.
Yeah, I like that visualization. I ran track, you know, growing up, ran track in college. Got four Mid-American Conference titles with Eastern Michigan University, I might add. But, you know, I learned from my coaches early on when I was in high school. And granted, I didn't even know my coach in high school was as fast as he was until I got grown. And I found out that Coach Demetrius Hollums had the state record in the 100-meter dash. And he's not that much older than, you know, I am. So you figure if I'm in high school, he was already like in his early 30s, right? And I'm like, you know, I'm thinking I'm the fastest guy around, right? And, you know, I lost like my first race in high school, you know, when I started in ninth grade. And he told me, say, man, do you visualize yourself winning? And I had never thought of that. You know, I was like 14, right? And I said, what do you mean? He said, begin with the end in mind. Do you visualize yourself crossing the finish line first? And I said, I never thought about that. That's the first time somebody ever asked me. Because I was coming from basketball and football, and baseball is my favorite sport. So understanding track and field as a science, I hadn't really thought about it. But track kind of parallels life in that regard.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because you're in your own lane.
Yeah, your own lane.
And every other sport, you uplifted by a team, and you can get by on having a poor mindset up to a certain part. But, like, when it comes to track, it's just you. And then mm-hmm. now it's in reverse. Instead of you relying on the team in the sense like the football team, you can rely on them to win because you don't have to get in to win the game. Your team is relying on you to win the race. You got to score the points at this point. And nobody else can do it for you.
Yeah.
I can't. Well, my event can't double count because you can't run the race. Like, you got to mm-hmm. do your own thing. But, yeah, my bad.
When, no, it's okay. I had the confidence, and I was one of the fastest guys around. But what I found is that, you know, sometimes I win, but then when I get to the bigger meets, I might not win.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And it wasn't because I wasn't able to.
Mm-hmm.
It was all of the mental preparation that went into it, right?
Yeah.
So I want to say it was around my 11th grade year that I finally put into action what he had asked me, that question, at the end of my 9th grade year when I was at the Junior Olympics. And I said, you know what? We were running against Kalamazoo Lloyd Norrix.
Yeah.
This was which is about 3 hours away from Detroit, but it's actually closer to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
It's about an hour from Chicago, mm-hmm. but it's like, you know, most of the trip from Detroit to Chicago is all of Michigan, and then you get to like a little snippet of Michigan in City, Indiana, and then you're there, right? So we had to drive the whole length of Michigan, leave school. It's a night meet, right? So we leave the school at like 3 o'clock. We get to their school at about 6. We're already tired from riding.
Yeah,
right?
From just sitting down.
And listen, so we're riding with Coach Willingham. Coach Willingham chain smokes cigarettes.
Oh, shit.
Right? So this is like, this is the early 90s, right? So back then, everybody was still smoking indoors. People are sitting in rooms like this at work and still smoking cigarettes, right?
Yeah.
And granted, it's not that they didn't know the health risk. I guess all of the things weren't put in place.
It was just cool back then. That just some everybody, it was a norm.
It was norm, it was right? Just, it was a normal thing.
That's what happened.
And I'm granted, if Coach Willingham even would have thought that it would have been harming us, you know, I'm sure he would have put it out.
Yeah.
But his nerves was bad, and he had to drive 3 hours, right? So we get to the track meet, we smelling like cigarettes, and we're warming up, and all of the kids are looking at us as if we smoked cigarettes.
It came out the jungle.
Right, so I said, you know what, I run into this guy, and I grew up with him, his name is Dwight Smith. So Dwight Smith went to Central High School, right?
Yeah.
He's one of the only defensive backs in NFL history to have 2 interceptions and return for 2 touchdowns when he played for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. This is my competition, right? So, you know, he's a grade younger than me, and he's like my stiffest competition. I'm like, you know what? I'm winning this today.
Yeah.
I'm not giving this one up. I've been running too long.
Yeah.
It's my turn, right?
You got to win.
So it wasn't a conscious decision to start visualizing. It was that. It was like, hey, look, you know what?
He was putting them
on. I'm winning this race, so yeah. I can make it through the prelims, make it through the semis, and now it's dark. The lights are on. And man, I jumped out in this race, Austin.
Yeah.
I think I ran about 10:57.
Wow.
In 100. And I was the only one. I'm waiting for the people on the side of me to edge me at the line or get to the line or we all get to the line at the same time. Ran away with the whole race. And when I got to the end, you know, Dwight was like, man, that was your best race you ran all year, man. He said, whatever you were doing, he said, man, keep doing that. Because we all, after the race was over, we were friends again.
Yeah.
You know.
That small, what, 11 seconds.
Are we trying to kill each other. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, but not, to your point, you know, visualization works. But, you know, for me, it was one of those things where it wasn't a conscious decision. It was kind of something that I evolved or grew into.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I guess you've grown into it, too.
Yeah, that's usually how it is. You can work for some, or people can tell you anything, you know what I'm saying? I can give all the information I can. I can give you all the free gems, the free sauce, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But it's never going to work until either it happens to you or you put it into action.
Yeah.
And then even when, like, I was younger, you would, like, tell me stuff. You know what I'm saying? You hear stuff from your parents, you're like, man, whatever, Nate. You know what I'm saying? I don't really want to hear it. So I ain't listening, you know what I'm saying? Whatever. And then it'd be, like, a couple weeks later, and then I'd be put in a situation. I'd be like, how do I tell him he was right? You know
right,
what I mean? You
yeah.
know what I'm saying? But it's like being able to remember back to information, recall information. And I used to think my memory was cooked because it'd be times where I'm trying to think about something, but it's just whatever, wherever you are currently, you only going to be able to use that information that relates to that situation. And that's something that I wrote about a minute ago was like, I was thinking about it because, you know, we got multiple midterms. You have multiple tests. So when you're studying for these tests, you're like, oh, how am I going to pull this off? But when you get to the test, you realize that on the math test, you think of math. On the reading test, you think of reading. On the science test, you think of science. But you put all this different information in your head, though. So what your brain does, it categorizes the information for you. So even though I'm studying for two subjects, and it may seem like, oh, how am I going to remember all of this stuff? It's all situational. So when I'm in that situation, then it'll regurgitate, and it'll be like, I know you thought I wasn't working, but here, that's all I got for you. You know what I mean? And that, yeah.
I'm still there.
Yeah.
Still there, man.
That stuff you put in.
Yeah. Still there.
It shows up years later, though. Like,
yeah, you never forget anything.
You never forget it. And even though it'll lay dormant, you won't think about it every day. When put in a situation, so it's kind of like timing, meeting, preparation.
Yeah, and right? That's what luck is.
Yeah. It's timing, meeting, preparation. So I give you an example. Like I say, I'm on my third career. I was working at my second career. Well, my first career was with the public school system. Second career was with General Motors, right? And worked a little bit in customer experience, manufacturing, quality. And then after 5 years, I went to finance. So in finance, I'm like one of the, I want to say one of the only black guys, maybe out of 2,000, you know. It just was a real, you know, it wasn't real diverse when you got up in the ivory tower of corporate America.
Yeah.
You feel what I'm saying? And what happened was is that, man, I rocked out. I mean, it was a difficult job because I worked in a top organization. And when they were coming out of bankruptcy, you know, it was a skill set that I had. And even though I didn't come from automotive, I was still able to help them plan their business, achieve a lot of their goals, pull themselves up out of the trouble that they had found themselves in, right? So after 10 years, I'm like, you know, when I first took the job, I was like, you know, my daughter's graduated. Austin's getting ready to graduate. If I can make it 10 years, right, at General Motors, because it's a cyclical industry. So it's just like what I was telling you before in 2000, when they laid off all of those people, they rehired all of those people, and it's just a cycle, right?
Yep.
So they get. I had this option. You say, hey, look, you either stay here and we downsize and get rid of you anyway, or you can leave. You know, so it was kind of like another early severance retirement, right?
Yeah.
Went to, left that industry and went to banking.
Okay.
And I'd never worked in banking before. I worked at the bankruptcy court when I was in college, you know what I mean? But it's not like working in banking. So right now I work at Comerica Bank, where I am a vice president for third-party risk and business unit risk for their technology controls office. First day on the job, you know, the lady I report to, she was like, I don't know where to start. We're trying to clean all of this stuff up. The feds are in. And I'm like, okay, I'm still not understanding. I don't know the terminology. I don't know anything, but I believe in my ability because I feel like I have a skill set that cuts through any industry. So, you know, a day goes by. I think about it that night, and she asked me, she said, I need you to come up with the operating model or efficiency model to kind of help get this stuff straightened out.
Yeah.
Can you do that? And I said, yeah, I can do it. I hadn't thought about it. I signed up for it. I agreed to it. I said, yeah, I'll be your third-party risk management champion.
So figure it out later.
I'll do it. And I guess so the next day it was like, oh, well, we need a deck. We need you to pull together the deck because now you have to go in front of the chief information officer and the chief technology officer to say how you're going to create this operating or this efficiency model. So I'm telling you, it was like, it takes me an hour to get to work, right? So it was about 50 miles away. I'm thinking, like, what the hell? I don't know. What could I tell them? So I started going back into my memory, like, what I did in undergrad and some of the people that I worked with. And then things, ways that I was able to clean stuff up in some of the jobs that I had had, right? Because even though you got one career, you might have 10 jobs within that one career because you ran these many different hats, right?
Yeah.
So in an effort to, you know, kind of think of something, I said, you know what? I said, we're going to analyze, sterilize, stabilize, and optimize. So I started coining this term and getting everybody on board. And they were like, well, okay, cool, but what is it? You know, so it was like this air of suspense, this mystery. And I say, well, you know, when you talk about analyze, sterilize, stabilize, and optimize, you're really talking about project toll gates to kind of bring into form ways to operate efficiently within an organization who works alongside suppliers. So imagine you got this business and you need to hire companies to help you do your business.
Yeah.
The thing is that a lot of these companies are top heavy when it comes to hiring these suppliers. And what happens is it's risk in everything that we do.
Mm-hmm.
But when you hire out and you contract out, the risk goes up.
Because now you got to, that's almost like, what's that movie? Not Reservoir Dogs. Is that Reservoir Dogs?
It's one of them, yeah.
The movie where it was like they was doing all these wholesaling guns to the military, so you can buy guns and then wholesale them to the military, and you can become like an independent contractor of them, and then they'll hit you up.
It wasn't Reservoir Dogs. What was it called? It was War Dogs.
War Dogs. Yeah. So these two guys, they doing a good job now. You know what I'm saying? They haven't got caught, even though it's a super illegal business. And then they try to get these bullets that were, like, super hard to find, and they found somebody who had them, and it was all, like, in the wrong language or something, right? So they hired somebody to do this, like, whole overnight process to where they changing the, they scratching off names on the bullets. They got a whole work team or whatever. And then, you know what I'm talking about? No. This is
an actual movie called War Dogs.
Yeah, this is a movie. So, yeah, War Dogs.
Similar. It was a similar skit as Snowfall.
So they, like, yeah, they trying to scratch the names off and put them in new boxes to make it look new and stuff. And the guys that was running it, that had been doing the wholesaling or whatever, that run the contracts, they put off paying the guy who set the team up to get all these guys to scratch him off. And so he like, I need my money. They done left. They done did the deal. They got the money. He like, he's calling, I need my money. And he wasn't even asking for a lot of money. They had the money, but they was like brushing him off. And when you get to the end, you see that everything goes downhill. Like, they cave in. They finally get caught. But they didn't even get caught for all the other stuff they did. Like, they didn't went through the dark triad in, what, Israel?
Everything.
Drove through the dark triangle that you're not supposed to go through. They didn't got away with stuff.
The Middle East. Yeah,
in the Middle East and stuff. And they get arrested. And all you see at the end is, like, a clip of the guy, like, talking to the people, like, yeah, this and that. They doing this and that. And they end up going to jail. So being able to, but they didn't get that big of a sentence.
The thing is, that contract was, like, 300-something million.
Yeah.
And all they had to pay the guy was, like, I don't know if it was $5,000.
Really? Not even a lot.
Like, it wasn't even a lot of money. It might have been $1,000. And they didn't pay him so he could pay his people.
Yeah.
And the thing is, similar to that, you know, when you think about trying to clean stuff up, and this is a nugget, man, for anybody in the school of business, you go in, you know, you want to develop these project toll gates, you know, and the
now what is a project toll gate? So, they may not know what that is.
A project toll gate is kind of like when you're working with a particular set of suppliers in this sense, right? And they do all kinds of business with you.
So
right?
Business to business.
It's business to business. All but right. The thing is, there's a lot of requirements on the banking side that the business who's paying for the service have to produce for the federal government.
Right.
You know, so
is that for like taxes and stuff or what?
It could be for anything. It's due diligence and it's inherent risk. It's everything, you know, because it's about trust.
Mm-hmm.
You're trusting people with your money. So when you think about systems, it's a lot of systems that go into a lot of these transactions.
Right.
And when you want to clean that up, you can't run fast at cleaning it up.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is with me and my situation where they had all year to kind of get it together, I got hired in 6 months into the year and I only had 6 months to get it together.
Yeah.
And I only had like two people to help me get it together. So, you know, there was this thing where, you know, while we're analyzing all of the data and we're trying to see exactly what the problem, let's just look at what we have. Even before we say this is the problem.
Yeah.
We're analyzing data.
Yeah.
We're in the analyzation phase. You have to analyze all the data. And when we say everything, we're talking about reporting data.
Right.
Key performance indicators. Mm. Key risk indicators.
Mm-hmm.
Do we work supplier performance evaluations? Have we worked with these suppliers before?
Yeah. And if so, how did those relationships go?
How did those relationships?
Are the people that we were working with back then even still there? Who's in management now? So, yeah, go ahead.
Because there's audit findings and everything it's big business, right?
Yeah.
So what happens with that analyzation phase is after you've looked at all of the data, you're sitting in a phase, which is a project toll gate, and you can't go to the next gate.
Until you finish that.
Until you finish this gate. And I kept having people that wanted to go fast. And the thing is, you can't go fast and you can't slow down. But if you do too much this way, it'll break because it's sensitive. It's all subjective. Like, people have to buy in. You got to get stakeholders and different departments to kind of agree to these things. And it's something new, something they've never seen before.
And that's how the crash in the housing market happened.
Same thing.
In 2008.
Well, it's the same thing. It's the financial industry. That involved the banks.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about, this is the cleanup.
Yeah.
So what happened was is that, you know, we had all these suppliers. We got to the sterilization phase.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got to the sterilization phase and I'm reporting out on it, we started finding duplicate data.
Okay.
We started finding stuff that they thought was the gold source of data, but it really wasn't, you know, because it was based on the system that they had last year.
Yeah.
And now they've moved to another system.
Yeah.
Well, what happened when they migrated from one system to the next? They lost information.
Mm.
And that's why all of the backlogs and all of the things that were required came about and was past due. Because it had already been done, but they lost the information, right?
Mm.
And it didn't happen intentionally because there's backups and there's safeguards and there's things like that. But when you get a person like me to come in and want to clean it all up, it's not sitting right there already made and pretty for you.
Mm. You got to go look for it.
You got to go look for it. So in that sterilization phase, we were able to answer a lot of the hard questions. We were able to get rid of a lot of stuff. We were able to look at contracts and say, hey, look, maybe we should change the contract language, because if they didn't submit the documentation we needed, then perhaps we need to call it out in black and white. That's way if someone takes over that job and that person's no longer there, at least the document that governs the processes on both sides with us and with them, mm-hmm. it's still written there. You feel what I'm saying? Yeah. And then we can change it in contract renewal, but mm-hmm. you got to get the language in there.
Yeah, and then a lot of companies, to get away with this stuff, there's a lot of loopholes in terms of like accounting and stuff, especially in the business world. It's called doublespeak. Have you ever heard of that?
Mm-mm.
So, you know, we talk about it. Yeah, the doublespeak is basically like using...
I like Fed talk.
Kind of, but like using... weaker language or stronger language, depending on what you're talking about. So say I'm talking to somebody that's quote unquote ignorant. I will use big words that sound super smart to him, even though I'm no more smarter than he is. You know what I mean? And that's what doublespeak is. And companies will go in and they will, to make it look like they're not failing, because you got stockholders if you're a publicly traded company. And if you're going through and you got to do the recap of the year or whatever it's called, you got to report to them and tell them what happened within the company, because they send from the outside. They just giving you the money. You know what I'm saying? So they just sitting out there like hoping you got it together. As long as I'm making money, I'm smooth. And you got to tell them that you lost half of their money that year. But how do you say it without saying, I lost half your money this year? Because they're going to panic, and then the business is going to go underground. So companies will go through and make a negative year look positive. And then they will tell it to you. And since you don't work there and you're not in the company, you don't really know what's going on. So you just take it at face value, but then later down the years, maybe in some random documentary that you see, you'll find out like, oh, I lost half of my money and the company was working overtime to get it back.
Yeah.
And I think, oh, that makes sense now, in terms of like we see all these billion-dollar organizations, but we don't really understand how in debt they probably are in. And that's probably why it's, oh, because you would be like, I was talking about yesterday how Shell leaves these oil wells inside the ocean. And they trying to figure out what to do with them. And it's $9 million to get it, to just sink it, just to, like, let it go, break it down, sink it into the ocean. And it's $70 to, what's it called, to pull it out, find somewhere to recycle it, this, this, and that. And you would say, well, the obvious choice is the $70 million because they're this rich. But they might be in debt. I don't want to call nothing out. I don't work there. But, like, may be more situations like that in terms of they in a hole that they trying to get out of. And how do I face this situation in terms of ethics and then in terms of saving myself? And Shell is an important company. You know what I mean? They provide gas for everybody. So they can't just go under. We can try to sink them under because it seems like the right thing to do. But if they are to go under, it may be more implications behind that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, to your point, and it's a point here, right? So when now that you're out of sterilization, you're off into the stabilization.
Yeah.
We had to leave breadcrumbs from which we came, right? So we're looking at all that we did, and since we're doing it, not for the first time, but we're the first ones to do it in a long time,
yeah,
we have to document the process.
Okay.
You know, that way, when you're looking at maintaining efficiency and standardization, you can always validate and change that process.
Yeah.
But you want that process to flow as smooth as possible, because you may not always be the person that's going to be in the role. So you leave breadcrumbs for the next person. And it's always the desk procedures that kind of helps a company stay solvent and out of that trouble. You know, they should have a situation where they're able to dispose of these things, where they can repurpose that stuff for other reasons. You know what I mean? Because there's other technology that could benefit from this, right?
Right.
Well, in the banking industry, it's nothing like an actual mechanical thing. It's all trust.
Yeah.
You know, so everything is based on your reputation, right? Now, Comerica, big bank, still kind of classified as regional, started out as it was a Detroit bank at first, and then it grew, and they moved their headquarters from Detroit to Dallas. Now, granted, I'm happy to be on the team because it gave me another opportunity to go into another industry and build another skill set.
Yeah.
You understand what
I'm
saying?
And get paid for it.
And get paid for it, right? And it's fun now. And like before, I can remember having certain careers and certain jobs, and I'm like, oh, man, I hope they don't lay me off. Austin's Montessori tuition is due. Oh, my God, the benefits. You know, so I'm thinking of all these things, but now I don't have to think about that anymore. So I'm able to absorb all of these information and say, hey, you know, it started with visualization. They couldn't see it. But I could see it because I had seen it before. Mm. And I'm like, if I got your buy-in, if you can trust that I'll fix this for you and lay out a strategy and a plan. You know, everybody's running around crazy. And they're like, oh, we don't know where to start. We don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're getting antsy, you know, because what happens is now senior leadership is getting involved. And when they start talking, not, it doesn't matter if they're right or not. They're your boss, and you're just going to try to give them what they want.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a key or a special, specific type of person to be able to push back on a senior leader. And you're almost risking everything, your job, you know, whether or not they like to work with you. But for me, I'm telling the honest truth.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not doing this for popularity reasons. You asked me to fix the problem. Well, we need to get this stuff cleared up. Well, hold on. Now, you gave me your buy-in. You said I had your buy-in for 6 months. You told me you want to trust me. If we're not where I said we will be in January, I'll leave. And that's just how that's how committed I was to it. And I don't even know this shit. This is a new industry for me. You know, but I have a skill set that I feel that can help them.
Yeah.
So July, wait a minute, you got accepted in May.
Yeah, no, March.
March.
Yeah.
When did you make your decision? It was in May when you said, hey, remember when we went to the school and you had your shirt on? And
oh, yeah, April. So it got accepted in March. We went to go visit April. And then after that,
it was like May 15th or May something, there, just before he graduated.
Yeah.
That was the day they offered me the job, right?
So I remember, that whole period. We was all trying to fill the forms. It was crazy.
So it was May, and it was like, you know, I'm doing another career switch, but it's cool. I've been here before. May, June, July. Now the shit is starting to hit the fan.
Yeah.
Everybody who caused the problems are no longer there. The suppliers that created these issues, that launched all of these due diligence questionnaires, is gone. So now we got like 300 things to clean up. I'm not going to get into the particulars, but we got 300 things to clean up, right?
Mm-hmm.
We get to October, and we're still sitting at like 200 and something things to clean up.
Yeah.
They're losing their wits. They're like, oh, you know, this is a dead stick. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. Where was all this panic and urgency before I got here? I didn't get here to May. So now that we're off and we're doing something and we're asking the hard questions and we're really trying to clean up, y'all ready to give it up? I said, no, let's hold the line. You know, and the thing is, it's all about leadership, mm-hmm. right? So when you think about me as a leader, say, anybody can steer the ship. And I got this from John C. Maxwell, 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. Anybody can steer the ship, but it takes a real leader to chart the course.
Yeah.
So in the spirit of visualization and seeing further down the line, right? That was just me charting the course.
Mm-hmm.
Got to December, man. We right around 91 things still needing to be done out of the 300. But people could see it. I started, you know, and it wasn't just me. I had a team of people.
See the light at the end of the tunnel.
But as the person that had to come up with the strategy, which it wasn't my responsibility to come up with the strategy, she gave me the assignment. So I said, hey, look, I'm going to run with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Got to about the end of the year, we were sitting at 42 things that needed to be completed. So we went from 300 to 42,
whoa.
Right? So then we get to January. Now we're down to 9. And then last week we were down to 1.
Yeah.
So now we're starting over, right? Everything's clear. Now everybody's excited and enthusiastic about optimization. But it started with visualizing where we would be in the future.
And then being confident in that visualization and understanding that it's more so like you got to say something going to happen and then you like, all right, now how I'm going to do it. Now, what do I have to do?
Didn't even know what to do.
Yeah,
now, I've seen it before, but it's banking. So it's not like working with ignition switches or car parts or semiconductor chips, like tangible stuff that you can put your hands on.
This is money.
This is money, man.
You gotta find the money that's no longer with you. It's like going through it.
Bank loans.
Got it. Yeah.
Bonds and stuff.
Yeah, it's
like
only
that.
Really 4 products that a bank sells, right? But, you know, I told them, they said, well, how are you able to see it? I say, well, you know, GM is a global company, and I sat right at the top of it. I had global responsibilities, kind of like what you were saying on your show yesterday where you talked about people having those meetings in China and Australia and all of that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was one of those guys where I had those global responsibilities. And what I'm saying is that when I got to Comerica, it was so much smaller than GM that I could just see everything that I needed to do. It kind of just jumped off the wall at me because the problems that I had seen in my previous place of work was massive, you know, humongous. You know, it took me years to get my mind around it.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to Comerica with my experience, it's like the problems just jumped off the wall.
Yeah.
Now, it happened in reverse with Detroit Public Schools because when I left Detroit Public Schools, or when I got to Detroit Public Schools, I think you were an infant.
Yeah.
I was working with charter schools. I was a grants manager. I traveled like 23 schools.
But yeah.
The thing about charter schools is that it's one entity. It's its own entity, right? But all of the operational things that go into a charter school is the same thing that goes into a school district that might have 2,000 schools.
Yeah.
So when I got to Detroit Public Schools, leaving the charter schools, it was the same thing. I came from a much smaller company, but it was so small that I saw the inner workings of how it all worked that when I got to the big company, it was almost like it was that small company
again. Understanding the micro and the macro. And then one thing I understood, not understood, but I learned from Michael Jordan, it's something that I use now. Like, just in terms of, like, in anything I do, I'm not the biggest, like, talker in terms of I'm going to talk down to you. But, hey, I'm going to talk, you know what I'm saying? Like, you got to know. So he was saying it's easy to talk while you up. You up 10, 15 points, it's easy to talk to me, you know what I'm saying? But if you could talk while you down, see, now that's the sign of a real man. That shows who a real man is, or a real woman, if you able to talk while you down. I can be down in the game 30 points, but I'm still give you buckets, you know what I'm saying? We going out, you know what I'm saying? If I'm losing by 30 and there's no way I can beat you in this game, I'm going to lose by 5, you know what I'm saying? I'm going to make you feel it. I'm going to make you feel like you lost at the end and I won in the end, but... Yeah, and then another thing Michael Jordan said is, I ain't never lost a game, I just ran out of time. You know what I'm saying? So it's just being able to have that confidence in yourself, even when things aren't going right. Now, I'll be honest, the numbers for the podcast wasn't looking good last month. You know what I'm saying? They wasn't looking good earlier last month. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, whatever. You know what I'm saying? Because you got to get yourself out of the analytics. And it's not even, all of this is, all these, the stories that I bring onto the podcast, they all true, you know what I'm saying? But when you hear these stories, you got to be able to take them out of the concrete sense of where they're in. Like, my dad was just talking about Comerica schools and stuff. Yeah, that's cool, you know what I'm saying? But you got to be able to, what's the underlying lesson? How can I apply this to my life, even though I don't relate to this certain situation?
Yeah.
So where was I going with that? Oh, yeah, just being able to talk while you down. Oh, dang, I lost it.
No, you got
Oh, no, the analytics. It's not all about the analytics, you know what I'm saying? And being able, I could stare those analytics in the face and say, you know, well, maybe it's something I could do better, you know what I'm saying? Maybe now it's time to get the clips going, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I had to, everybody got tired of, you know, just listening to it. They want to see who's behind the camera. Who's the man behind, who's the voice? Like, they want to see it. So I was like, all right, boom, I'm going to get more cameras going. I'm going to get more clips going. I'm going to just keep posting and getting it out because maybe it ain't supposed to pop yet.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be, like, aware of what's going on. Don't just get down because everything not going up. Sometimes you need them to be down and the spotlight off of you so you can work a little bit. You know what I'm saying? Because when the spotlight on you, it's kind of hard to, you know.
I think he said it best, actually.
What
when you said, hey, look, you know, if I knock on all these doors for 8 hours.
Yep.
I know. So I used to feel like that when I would talk to girls when I was young. And we didn't have
because he didn't have a social media.
We didn't have social media.
He always had to talk to the girls.
Yeah, we had to actually go talk to him.
Dang, yeah.
And we would go to a mall. We didn't have cell phones and all that stuff. We
so
really,
you got to remember her number.
Or if we had an ink pen. Yeah. Make sure you had an ink pen.
And
you had
don't
a little
wash
black
your hands.
Book.
You know what I'm saying?
Or she write it on. You can't wash your hands. And
what was that?
And then your handwriting bad. You like, damn, is it an 8 or is it a 2?
Can't remember. You done tried every number, right? And these are like, I'm telling you right now. And then don't let her be around her friend. So, you know, and me, I was notorious for walking up to a girl and she was around with all the friends. Because after a while, I didn't care anymore. Like, I told you, baseball was my favorite sport. So I know if I talked to 10 girls at the mall and 3 of them gave me my number, that's Hall of Fame worthy.
Yeah,
that's 30%.
That's 30%.
That's Hall of Fame number.
Yeah, any sport. What's a good 3-point percentage in the NBA? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm telling you.
It'd be 33%. You'd be like, dang, only 1/3 of his 3-pointers going, but they count for 3 points.
They count for 3 points.
So it's like,
law of average.
Yeah, being able to do that. Go ahead.
You're gonna come across somebody who wants what you have, you know.
Yeah.
Eventually,
just pushing through.
You're never gonna go to zero. It's always a market for yourself. You know what I mean? And the trial and error to get to that market is just you figuring out who your customers are. Even in marketing class, we learn that every day. It's like what these companies are doing is they're not trying to reach everybody in the world, even though that would be cool. But even in terms of running a company, that would be super hard to take care of everybody in the world. So they just look for their direct markets, and they change, and they grab onto them, and they don't let them go.
They don't, man.
Your most valuable customer is the person that buys from you the most. You got to pay attention to that customer. You know what I'm saying? I can reach out to all the states, but if I start treating my friends like crap, I'm gonna lose those guaranteed 10 downloads. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I got to be able to tailor them and ask them what they look for, and then worry about the rest later, because then the people from outside, you know what I'm saying, the supporters from outside, they'll give their feedback and I'll listen. But the people most important to me is the people who actually listen and want to see me keep going. So take care of your most valuable customer, and those are the ones that's closest to you. And then even back to what I was saying about the companies, yeah, they're scaling to see who likes the brand, and then they disregarding whoever don't care about it. You know what I'm saying? I'm not going to go keep looking for new markets, because then I'm going to end up ignoring my most valuable customer, and then I'm going to go under. So I'm going to pay attention to what I need to first, and then if it's a chance for me to expand, I'll expand. And then more recently, we were talking about an marketing class with Hank Wozniak. I love that guy, dude. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Perfect.
Oh, we got to go see him after this.
Okay.
Hold on. The class, wait, it ended around like 6 minutes ago. I'll text him, but okay, we'll wrap up. But anyways, we was learning about globalization and stuff, so... My dad was telling me certain words on the podcast. I don't care, but you got to calm down, because now it's getting out to the rest of the world, and not all the cultures talk like this. So they might not, even though you speak in English, it might not translate directly to what they're hearing and stuff. So being able to understand the global market and who you are reaching, and now you got to tailor to, used to be just Detroit and Los Angeles I was reaching to, so they understood the slang words I would use. But then it turned into 30, 40 other states. And then 20 other countries, you know what I mean? So now it's like, how can I put this dialect in a term that everybody can understand and everybody can relate to? So that's one thing I'm tailoring now to reach that global market. Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing, man.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Exciting.
You got cheat code over here, too. And I'll be honest with you, man. I'm so proud of you, Austin. Like, I just be honest with you, man. When I was growing up and my dad was there, and you probably had a similar experience with your dad. They didn't say, hey, look, son, this is how you be a man. No, it's the essence of you being around, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I just didn't want to do what my dad did for a living. You know, my dad went to work every day. He was a pipe fitter by trade. And he had gotten into a sentinel event at work where he fell through a floor 50 feet, right?
Shit.
But years before that, he had took me to work with him one day. And it was like below zero, because it gets pretty cold in Detroit. So he's like, hey, you want to ride to work with me? I was like, yeah, I'll go.
Boiler rooms, boy. Go ahead,
This is beneath the boiler room. This is where the steam pipes are underground.
It's super high.
So if it's
down
0 degrees up on top of the surface, below the ground or under where they are in that project unit, it's like 200 degrees.
And they down there all day.
All day, man. Jeez. My dad used to come home. I mean, mud would be up to his waist. Mm-hmm. I would have to. He'd be too tired. I had to take his shoes and socks off. You know what I mean? Like, he couldn't bend over. He couldn't do it. So when he got hurt, he was like 37.
Young.
He had just turned 37. And he never went back to work again. They had to retire him because he was, you know, he had this disability. But I told him, I said, hey, you know, I just really can't do all of that stuff that you did. And he was like, man, stay your ass in school. And I said, you know what, bet? If I stay in school, he said, yeah, you stay your ass in school. If you don't want to have to do this, stay in school. So, you know, I kind of appreciate that. You know, my grandmother, she was a, she had her PhD in education, so she was real big on education, right? So that made it real easy to stay in school. You know what I'm saying? But just the hard work is not for everybody.
Yeah.
When I say hard, I mean like that dirty job.
Yeah.
Ooh, can't do that. Nah, I'm good. I don't want to do that. I don't like getting my hands dirty.
I'm telling you, man.
Yeah. But Aurelio, I want you to close this one out, because you were talking about how you was learning to be a leader. And right now you're on your way to being whatever you want to be. You know what I'm saying? Even though I don't know what that looks like yet. You was able to put projects into perspective, and then from perspective to actuality.
Yeah.
He was like, I'm going to go start the window company. I got hurt. Can't do that one, but I'm going to go clean windows. That's a little bit more safer, but I'm still doing it. And being able to see the ups and downs of that, it really, even if one project don't pop off, you know what I'm saying? Even if it don't scale, like his situation, he was still able to take those skills that he learned and use them somewhere else. So how do you feel like you've grown as a leader from even being like maybe in middle school or high school to where you are now, and then where do you kind of see yourself going, if you just put it out there?
Man, so...
you don't got to give me any details or, like, any deep plans, you know what I'm saying?
I
don't want people steal me ideas, but you get it.
I got you. Yeah, go ahead. So, when it comes to like leadership, I guess for me, it first starts with like being able to like understand, hear people first. Yeah. You know? So I first want to, I'm just practicing on, or just getting better at just really listening, you know, and remembering what other people say. And there's like what I've been learning from my organizational behavior and leadership class. I have a great professor, Jason Friend.
Nice. Talk to him. Oh, yeah. I keep forgetting email.
But he, there's three different ways that you could communicate to people. You have to be aware of like who you're trying to lead, you mm-hmm. know, and it's going to be different. It varies from person to person, you know. But I guess with what you said about, you know, when you want to be a leader, you got to have that roadmap for mm-hmm. them, you know.
Yeah.
You kind of got to tell them like, hey, this is where we're going to go. You know, the rides, you know, it's going to be a little rough, but, the, you know, we got to take care of
it's
stuff,
what we gotta
you know.
Do, yeah.
And it's a way where they could like also, I feel like being a leader is really taking out the leader within them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where they could like have the confidence within themselves and you could trust them as well.
Yep.
You yeah. know, I had an amazing team. I love the guys I had, you know. But during that time, you know, it didn't go to the direction that I wanted it to, you know, so I had to shut it down. Now I'm working on rebranding and, you know, eventually want to get back into it.
Yeah.
You know, but I know what I'm looking for. You know, yeah. I know like how I'm gonna go about it this time, you yep. know. And it's really just taking, you know, I was really discouraged when I had to shut the team down.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, you know, this sucks. I worked so hard for this, you know, and it's really like if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you know, you're not always going to make it that first time. Yeah. You know, you got to continue to push. And so, you know, I took the time. I really just reflected on that experience. And, you know, I learned a lot. The money that I would have gotten if I would have pushed through.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have made it for the lessons that I wouldn't have been able to recognize at the time.
Which priceless.
You know,
yeah,
and so those lessons, like
cost
I could take them. Everywhere,
yep.
you know, and I feel so much more confident now, you know, when I, you know, what I plan on going into, you know,
yeah.
and just learning, you know, I want to get into like really like the dirt type of work, you know, get mm-hmm. into the service based industry, like electrician, plumbing, construction,
yeah.
you know,
mm-hmm.
But you got to be able to lead those type of people,
yeah.
you know,
understand
and like
where
you said, there's
from.
A market for it now.
It is,
you know, like the trade schools, like
yep.
it went to schooling, right? You know, universities, people getting these corporate jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a high demand for these trade schools.
yeah, yeah,
and I see that.
Yep.
And I want to get into it,
yeah,
you know?
Man, I don't want to jinx it, you know? Not even jinx it, but yeah,
you know,
that's what you're doing.
I like to say, like, whatever door closes, it closes, you know? And the door next door is probably going to open for me. So I don't
yeah.
worry about it. If that shuts down, you know, then I know that for me, I believe in God, but know that God has a plan for
oh,
me,
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
the journey.
Yeah.
So, a big principle I've learned and I'm really trying to put into practice is like, don't get discouraged when your work doesn't start working for you, you
mm.
know, because it's working on you.
Mm.
And there's going to come a time where it starts working for you,
yeah.
you know, and then during that work period, really focus on what you're putting in because
yeah.
you're going to reap what you sow, you know?
Yeah.
Nice.
True.
All right. So, Dad, I'm going to go with you first. What's the quote of the day?
Confucius.
Confucius, grab it.
Confucius, life depends upon diligence. The mechanic that wants to perfect his work must first sharpen his tool.
Nice. Aurelio?
Man. You know, Patrick told me about a quote, and I think I already said it, but it's like, don't get discouraged when the work's working on you, you know,
yeah.
because eventually it's going to start working for you.
Nice.
I like that.
Yeah,
that's
a good
one. I do like that one.
Good so, one. Thank you all for coming on, and thank you to anybody who listened this far. I appreciate it. Somebody will probably listen this far, but
oh, yeah.
thank you. I love you all. Thank you.
Thanks,
Austin.
All right.